From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, actor and comedian Bill Murray. He won several awards for his role in the 1998 film Rushmore. A special edition DVD of the film has just been released. We'll talk about Rushmore and Murray's other films. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction by historian Linda Gordon, about Irish orphans adopted by Mexican-American families at the turn of the century. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Keith Jarrett's new solo piano CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The two grandmothers of Elian Gonzalez are in New York City, appealing for the six-year-old boy's return to Cuba. NPR's Melissa Block attended a news conference at which Elian's maternal grandmother spoke of her daughter, the boy's mother.
Raquel Rodriguez is Elian's maternal grandmother. It was her daughter who died at sea in the effort to reach Florida. And there was a very emotional moment of the news conference. She broke down when she described that for her daughter to rest in peace, that Elian needed to be returned home. She also mentioned that it was not her daughter's wish to go to Florida. She implied that she was forced into it by her boyfriend, who the grandmother said was violent and harsh with her, and that it was not her desire to come to Florida, and therefore that it would certainly not be her desire that Elian stay here.
NPR's Melissa Block at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. The Supreme Court has agreed to review the practice of open primaries. The challenge comes from California, which currently allows voters to cast their ballots for any candidate in the primary elections, regardless of party affiliation. Supporters say the open primary system encourages the nomination of more moderate candidates who are more likely to be acceptable to voters from other parties. Critics say the system interferes with the right of party members to choose who will represent them. As Monday night's caucuses near, Democratic and Republican presidential hopefuls are canvassing Iowa, making final appeals to the voters. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Every candidate but Arizona Senator John McCain will be in Iowa this weekend, engaged in last-ditch efforts to ensure their supporters turn out Monday night. McCain has chosen to bypass Iowa, hoping instead for a strong showing in the New Hampshire primary, which follows a week later. Democrat Al Gore and Republican George W. Bush are heavily favored to win their party's caucuses, but close attention will be paid to how closely their rivals finish as well. Monday night, 10% of Iowa's registered voters will gather in living rooms, churches, and even grain elevators to announce their support of specific candidates. It'll be the first contest of the nomination race. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News, Des Moines.
Democratic presidential hopeful Bill Bradley says he's had several incidents of irregular heartbeats since he first disclosed his condition last month. The 56-year-old former senator said his arrhythmia is a nuisance but won't have any impact on his campaign. Doctors have said the condition is not life-threatening and easily controlled with medication. Questions about Bradley's health have dogged his campaign lately as he tries to build support among Democrats before Monday's Iowa caucuses. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 100 points to close at 11,252. Declines led advances by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 1,208 million shares. This is NPR. President Clinton says his new budget will propose federal funding to help millions of poor families get access to the Internet. The president said there's a digital divide that's keeping the poor from getting the information available to other Americans. He says the Internet should be as available to Americans as the telephone. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports there's been a sharp increase in the number of refugees fleeing intensified fighting in Chechnya to the neighboring Russian Republic of Ingushetia. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency estimates about 2,300 Chechens crossed into Ingushetia yesterday. Spokesman Ron Redmond says this represents the highest daily figure in several weeks.
It's not immediately clear whether that group included residents of Grozny itself or other areas in Chechnya.
Just a few days ago, the refugee agency reported all escape routes out of the capital, Grozny, were blocked, trapping up to 25,000 civilians in the city. The agency also reports about 800 people in Ingushetia went back to safe, Russian-controlled areas in northern Chechnya on Thursday. Redmond says there are unconfirmed reports about draft-age men being detained at the border. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
President Clinton went to Pasadena, California today to announce a proposal that would spend $2.8 billion for basic science and medical research. Speaking at the California Institute of Technology, the president said he'll ask Congress to approve funding for research in cancer, diabetes, and AIDS, as well as development of faster computer technology. The president said that basic research can contribute to the nation's economic growth. This is NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from National Public Radio Stations and the Ford Foundation, a resource for people and institutions worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his days as a cast member on Saturday Night Live, Bill Murray perfectly captured self-absorbed, disingenuous showbiz types. Who can go to a lounge without thinking of Murray's impressions of cheesy lounge singers? His subsequent film acting career evolved from broad comedies like Ghostbusters and Caddyshack to more complex roles in such films as Groundhog Day and Mad Dog and Glory. For his performance in the 1998 film Rushmore, he won Best Supporting Actor awards from the Los Angeles and New York Film Critics Circle and the National Society of Film Critics. A special edition DVD of Rushmore has just been released. On this archive edition, we feature our 1999 interview with Bill Murray about Rushmore and his earlier films. Rushmore is set at a private school called Rushmore Academy. Murray plays Mr. Bloom, a self-made millionaire and school benefactor. Here's an early scene in which he's addressing the student body.
Thank you. You guys have it real easy. I never had it like this where I grew up. But I send my kids here because the fact is, you go to one of the best schools in the country, Rushmore. Now, for some of you, it doesn't matter. You were born rich and you're going to stay rich. But here's my advice to the rest of you. Take dead aim on the rich boys. Get them in the crosshairs and take them down. Just remember, they can buy anything, but they can't buy backbone. Don't let them forget it. Thank you.
The one person applauding that speech is the film's central character, Max Fisher. Max loves his school, and he's also fallen in love with one of the teachers. And he needs Mr. Bloom's financial help to impress her. Things get complicated when Mr. Bloom, whose marriage has fallen apart, also falls in love with that teacher.
This strikes me as a role that's kind of different from your other film roles, in part because I think there's a lot of sadness at the root of this character.
Well, his role in the film is to be someone who would like to go back and, you know, somehow he forgot what he was thinking about when he was 17. He's made a lot of money. He's got a family that he's not happy with. He's not happy with his life. He's got a Bentley and a nice suit, but he's not interested in himself. He finds his own life pretty disappointing. And here's a kid who is interested in everything, you know, what he does at his school is he starts new clubs at all times. You know, he founded the fencing club, the miniature UN, the beekeepers, the calligraphy club. He's a cheerleader. He does everything. He just throws himself into activities, hoping to find one that works for him. I think people have forgotten your question by now. I know I did, but you said a lot of sadness. So there's a lot of sadness in this fellow, and that it makes you sadder to see someone that's really happy, really engaged in life when you have detached.
Do you think you played this role differently than other roles that you've had?
Well, I think I tried to work a little deeper than I usually do because there's more stuff in this, you know. Sometimes the roles you get are, they're really about performance. They're really about getting from point A to point B and the least amount of time with the most entertainment value, and the depth isn't going to be much of a factor. In this movie, I tried to bring a little bit more of my own personal, you know, vocabulary into it. Not vocabulary, but my own emotional history into it, so that it it felt the way that I've felt when I've had these same emotions.
I don't imagine, though, you'd feel a lot of the same kind of regret that this character would. I mean, well, you found the work that is meaningful for you?
I have found a work that's meaningful for me, but I have regrets about, you know, the idealism that I had when I was 17 and what I have now and how hungry. You know, it's kind of hard to stay hungry through your life, especially when you have success in your job. It's tough to wake up in the morning with a zeal, you know. Sometimes a lot gets done for you, and there's not as much of your own knocking down doors and much of your own grinding. All of a sudden, there are people willing to open doors for you and push things out of the way for you to make it easy for you. And somehow that it's a different ride than the one you started out on. I haven't forgotten it. I still know what it feels like, but it just does prepare you a different way when you walk into work every day.
My guest is Bill Murray. I'm a great fan of your movie acting, and I want to talk to you about a couple of your earlier films. Let's start with Groundhog Day, in a film in which I think a lot of people noticed how really funny you were as an actor in, you know, in an adult comedy. In Groundhog Day, you played a TV weatherman sent to cover Groundhog Day in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and that's the site of the official groundhog. And each subsequent morning, you wake up again to relive Groundhog Day. The same day keeps happening over and over and over again. Was this a change in your career from more... I can't remember what year this was.
Well, I can't either. I used to know, but I don't know anymore. It was in the early 90s or something like that.
Did you see this 80s? As a change from more kind of kid-oriented comedy to more adult-oriented comedy?
That was just a much more sophisticated script than most scripts that you ever see. You know, that was an incredibly original idea. This kid, Danny Rubin, this idea just sprung full-blown from his head. He'd never even been to Punxsutawney until I took him there. And he wrote this whole script based on this event. But really what he was talking about was the idea of being stuck in the same day, that if you don't work on the change of the improvement of yourself, that you are stuck and you have to start over every single day. I mean, it really worked on a lot more levels than most of the scripts that I'd done at that point.
How much improvisation did you do in this film?
In that one?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did a fair amount. I mean, I worked on the script, too, with him. And so I added things. And you're always adding things. But I can make lines up. That's not hard, you know. So I don't take credit for writing films unless I've really sat down at a typewriter and worked. But doing the same scenes over and over again, you're in the same situation over and over again, you're constantly getting a little bit more inspiration, and you have the benefit of, it's almost like lots of rehearsal, you know. If you rehearse something many times, more and more things come to you. So I had an advantage over the writer in that I got to really just sit in the space, the physical wear of it, and a lot of things come to you.
In the beginning of the movie, you have some very funny weatherman patter. Did you watch a lot of TV weathercasts in part to prepare for the role?
Well, that was when, that was when Weather Channel was first getting big, and I was one of the first people to really devote my entire life to the Weather Channel, which is now what I do. And I got a huge kick out of it, and I really insisted that they buy ads on the Weather Channel when the movie came out so I could watch the ads. But I love the Weather Channel. It's it really is, you know, the drama and the power of these fronts, you know. You get to see something really important happening, and it's dealt with in a real... And there's even more talk about it, but nothing can be done.
Why don't we hear you doing the weather from the beginning of Groundhog Day?
Okay.
Somebody asked me today, Phil, if you could be anywhere in the world, where would you like to be? And I said to him, probably right here, Elko, Nevada. Our nation's high at 79 today. Out in California, they're going to have some warm weather tomorrow, gang wars, and some very overpriced real estate. Up in the Pacific Northwest, as you can see, they're going to have some very, very tall trees. It'll be clear across the Rockies and the Great Plains mostly, but look out, here comes trouble. Oh, boy. Front coming our way. Look out. What's that going to mean to us here in the Three Rivers area? One of these big blue things, this cold, frigid Arctic air, this big mass coming out of the north. It's going to meet up with all of this moisture coming up out of the Gulf, going to mix together at high altitudes and cause some snow. Going out on a limb now, not going to hit us here in Pittsburgh, going to push off and hit Altoona. Close call, folks. Let's take a look at the 5-day.
That's Bill Murray in a scene from Groundhog Day. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
'Cause he gets up in the morning, then he goes to work at 9, then he comes back home at 5:30, gets the same train every time. 'Cause his world is built on punctuality, it never fails, and he's all so good.
Let's get back to our 1999 interview with Bill Murray, recorded after the release of his film Rushmore. A special edition DVD has just been released.
I want to talk about another movie that I think is a really terrific film, and I regret that I think very few people actually saw it. And it's called Mad Dog and Glory. And the screenplay was by novelist Richard Price, who's probably best known for Clockers. And you play a loan shark in this who owns a comedy club and really wants to be a stand-up comic. And you even get to do stand-up as this mobster in the movie. Did you write the comedy for this?
I don't quite remember. I mean, I know I did something in it. I added something to it. But the basic idea was Price's. I mean, this is another example of not doing too much because the writing was so good.
Yeah, he's a great writer.
Yeah, he's really good. I mean, his stuff was so lovable. I couldn't wait to go to work and try to make these lines work. They were so challenging and so, it was like having a knuckleball, you know. You didn't know how it was going to land, and you just tried to really be, just try to get out of the way and let the line work. It was a really good job.
You know a lot about delivery and comedy, but your character doesn't know a lot about it, particularly at the beginning of the film when he's really very stiff. And tell me a little bit about playing a comic who doesn't know what they're doing.
Well, I found that mobsters are, the ones I've met, are really funny people. You know, that's part of the paradox is that they're often the most charming people. And the terror of what they're like in their criminal side is almost hard to imagine. But his readings of his lines were had a menace to them. That, you know, it was his club. You could be thrown out if you perhaps you could be thrown out if you weren't enjoying yourself, enjoying the act. And it gave him a confidence to say it any old way he wanted. And he talked almost like he was talking to his posse, you know, to his own, what do the hoods call their group, you know, their gang. And it was an angry kind of comedian, you know. He was angry. He was, he had a chip on his shoulder, and he truly spoke down to his audience. At the same time was delighting in the fact that he was that what he was doing and the way he spoke his comedy was now getting public notice. You know, he was charmed with himself. He was really enjoying himself.
Why don't we hear a scene from early in Mad Dog and Gloria where you, the mobster, are doing comedy at the club you own.
Thank you.
With a lot of your boys in the audience.
Casa Nostra. Our thing. Our thing, my ass. Cosa Nostra is Italian for cheap bastards. Cosa Nostra babies, other babies, they're born, they cry, they go, Our kids, they cry. They go, what?
Yeah, he probably heard some comedian sometime say, well, you gotta work with your life. You gotta use your life as your comedy.
Well, in this movie, Bill Murray, you got to work opposite Robert De Niro. And De Niro plays a cop who's a forensic photographer, and he saves your life in a convenience store holdup. And to thank him, you loan him a beautiful young woman played by Uma Thurman, and you basically own this woman because she owes you about $75,000, and she pays it off by doing whatever favor you ask of her. And in this scene from later in Mad Dog and Glory, you've come to pick her up, but De Niro doesn't want her to go because he's fallen in love with her. Let me play an excerpt of this scene.
Bring it down, Wayne.
I love her.
You love her.
I own her!
I knew it! I knew it! I knew it! Didn't I call it right on the nose when I saw you in the office? You're a schmuck if you don't think she's playing you like a violin right now. Women. F***ing women, you can't live with them, you can't kill them. Okay. If you want, you can assume the debt.
Assume the debt?
Yeah. Be my friend. For what, I don't exactly know. You're a cop. Maybe something, maybe nothing. You want me to forget about her. For the next year, if I call you, you have to pick up the phone. That I can live with.
Bill Murray, what was it like to work opposite Robert De Niro? And I'm thinking, you know, you're such a verbal guy and you're so good at improvising, and De Niro seems much less verbal.
Well, he is less verbal, but he's also, he's got a lot going on. This guy is, he's not, our favorite for nothing. He works very hard at his job. He's a hardworking guy and he's serious about his job. I tend to, like, keep it light and goof around on the set just so I'm relaxed. And that got a little distracting for him at one point. I remember one day thinking, oh, God, he was like, yeah, can we just do this here now? But we've become friends. I met him over the years, pardon me, before this, and I like talking to him. You know, I think he likes my verbal qualities, and I like his sort of surprising sense of humor. Working with him was, I actually had to fight this guy, too. And, you're fighting a guy who's some sort of a method actor. You don't know what's going to happen. I'm basically going to go inside on the raging bull here. I'm thinking, God, if he starts throwing combinations at me, I'm going down. He's in incredible physical shape. He's not an imposing figure to look at, but he is in incredible shape. And he works really, really hard. And he appreciated, and I love to work hard with people. And I like to work off camera with people. And, as great as he is, everybody needs another actor to help him do it, And that was just wonderful to find out that nobody's alone out there, no matter how good you are. And I delighted in really pushing him, and getting him, like if he was supposed to be angry in a scene and I was behind the camera, I would infuriate him. I would enrage him,
How?
Well, I mean, he's a man who demands respect. That's one thing. You have to respect him. And if you disrespect him, he goes crazy. He will really not like you, But in character, you could get away with that. You could disrespect him, and it would enrage him. And he's, he's very proud of his heritage, too, And if you somehow didn't respect the heritage, you would see something happen in his eyes that was just terrifying, really scary. And I enjoyed getting it from him, and I think he appreciated that I wasn't so too afraid to do it,
Is this kind of intimidation that you're talking about extracurricular or just stuff in the script?
Oh, extracurricular.
Like what would you do?
Well, see, because I'm off camera, his lines are, and as long as I don't overlap him, I don't talk on his lines, I can say anything to get the response out of him. So if you called him, you know, used an Italian slur of some sort, he would just, he could not control himself. It's, you know, because it, you know, he grew up, where he grew up in the downtown, you know, there was an Italian neighborhood, and they, you know, they were, you know, they had their turf, and they were very protective of their own, you know. Anybody from the outside was a potential troublemaker, and those insults were a throwdown, you know. And you don't speak that way. If you spoke that way, you're just asking for real trouble, you know, and it had to be responded to, you know. So in character, you know, I could say things to him that would enrage him and infuriate him, you know, and I would build it up, go beyond the script. I find that that's really, you know, it's a technique, it's a thing you can do, that I don't think most people do it.
Bill Murray recorded last year. Later in the show, we'll talk more about his movies and his comedy. Here he is on Saturday Night Live as a lounge singer.
Well, good night, everybody. And this is Nick Summers saying a Minnehaha summer is a fun summer. That's what you're here for. That's what I'm here for. I am a fun guy, and I hope that you had fun tonight. Saying one more thing. I want you just to remember to sing. That's right. Sing a song. Sing it loud. Sing it short. Remember to put on some 612 when you go out. Sing it happy, not sad. You know, we got bears over the garbage dump. Just flash your headlights. Sing of the good times and not the bad. Well, no matter if it's not good enough. This is my seventh summer up here for anyone else to hear. Just sing. Sing a song. Please, won't you sing me a song? Thank you. Good night.
Bill Murray, his movie Rushmore has just been released on a special edition DVD. Here's a song used in the film. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Trees swaying in the summer breeze, showing off their silver leaves as we walked by. Soft kisses on a summer's day, laughing all our cares away, just you and I. Sweet
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from the National Endowment for the Arts. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Beacon Press, publishers of All Souls, a family story from Southie by Michael Patrick McDonald. Available at bookstores everywhere. On the web at www.beacon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We're listening to music from Keith Jarrett's new solo CD. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews it. Maureen Corrigan reviews a new nonfiction book about Irish orphans adopted by Mexican-American families at the turn of the century. And we continue our conversation with Bill Murray. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're featuring a 1999 interview with Bill Murray. His movie Rushmore has just come out on a special edition DVD. He's currently in Cradle Will Rock. Later this year, he'll star in Vec as in Wreck, and he'll play Polonius in a new movie adaptation of Hamlet.
I want to move on to another movie that I think is really funny, and it's a Farrelly Brothers movie, but it's one of their lesser-known films. It's called Kingpin. And you play a bowling hustler in it. And I'm wondering how the Farrelly Brothers' humor compares to yours. And here's something. You know, we played a talk that they gave at the Comedy Film Festival in late 1998. And one of the things that they said in this talk was that you did a lot of improvising in the film, and that you were just so spontaneously funny that, you know, they just let you do it. I don't know what your memories are of that.
Well, that's right. That was I turned down this movie once, and then they came back and said, well, how about a different part? Actually, how about two different parts? They'd combined two different parts into another part. And they said, would you like to try this? And I looked at it, and I wasn't sure how the whole thing was going to work, but I was sort of coming out of a funny time in my life, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I should just go out there and make this work. I don't know if the whole thing's... Usually I don't take a job if I don't think the whole thing is going to work, and I didn't really know, so... But I wanted to work, and I knew I could be funny in this part, so I took it. And they're fertile fellas, and they're always game to change anything. They have more fun making movies than anybody I've ever worked with. It really is a riot. They were always saying, okay, how about, you know, they'd come up to me and they'd say, oh, here's one. How about if you stuck a banana in your nose? And, you know, their comedy is a little, it's different than mine.
And, yours is more character-oriented and theirs is more physical?
Well, I don't know. Theirs is a little more, I'll say rollicking, you know, but it also has a sort of a smatter kind of effect, you know. They will not stop at any, they will go to any length.
Yes, exactly right. They won't stop at anything. And were there times when you decided, no, that's too broad, we ought to stop here?
Well, I didn't see everything that was in the movie, and when I finally did see the movie, I was... God, I went, holy cow. I was happy with all my stuff because I did all my stuff, but the stuff I hadn't seen, I was just, oh, man, oh, God. You know, it was rough. The first scene of the movie is so rough, and I'd taken my boys, and they were, I don't know, I thought it'd be okay to take them to this movie. I mean, I think they were like 14 and 11 or 13 and 10 or something, and they were shocked, really shocked. I mean, the first scene in the movie involves, you know, sex with an extremely unflatteringly painted woman. You know, not a painted woman, but a woman that's made to appear just almost like grisly. You know, and there it's like retching and terrible, and I was stunned into total like ice, goose flesh, hair standing up on your skin, silence through the entire movie. And I left the movie theater thinking, oh my God, what have I done taking him to this thing? And we walked in silence from the movie to the car, which was in an underground parking lot. We must have walked 3/8 of a mile. And my 10-year-old finally said, you were good, Dad. It was really sad. I felt like, you know, the child services was going to come and, you know, take me in. You took them to that? But so their taste goes beyond mine. You know, I wish I could work with them all the time and have Final Cut.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to choose a scene that you improvised in part from Kingpin.
Oh, there's one line that I improvised I don't know if this is a play on the radio. There was a scene that I improvised the one line of, and it's a scene where I'm eating breakfast with Woody. And this guy just hits on anybody. He's like a peccary. Is that animal that's in the zoo? It's kind of a small-time pig that they can... It's one of the few animals they have in the Central Park Zoo is a peccary. And they have a thought, and then they want to mate. And then they have a thought, and then they want to mate. It's pretty much that's their pattern. But this guy was like that, where his impulses were basically, I'm fed, and now a woman, please. You know. So I did this. I just sort of made up this line where it's just, and it's a horrible offensive line, but it's my standard of offensiveness, and to show to, you know, as opposed to theirs. Just
okay. Let's hear the scene.
It'll this will offend my people out there. People on my wavelength.
This is Bill Murray in Kingpin.
Young bowler like yourself. The tour can be very difficult, very expensive.
Tanqueray and tap.
Keep them coming, sweets. I got a long drive. Do me a favor, will you? Would you mind washing off that perfume before you come back to our table? A little bad luck. If you had it today, all your dreams can go up in smoke. That's why even we veteran bowlers, we work our way from tournament to tournament. We need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra, is what it means. You interested?
Interested?
Would you be interested in extra income?
No, extra income.
You want to make more money? Okay. Why don't you go eat that outside and then come on back in? Hi.
Hello.
Not you. Hi.
Hi.
That's a scene from Kingpin, which was made by the Farrelly brothers, who also made Something About Mary and Dumb and Dumber. And just in case our listeners couldn't make out the final words of that scene, can you tell us what you were saying to the women at the next table?
I said, no, not you. You.
Right.
It's just a guy who's hitting on women at the next table, and one woman responds and goes, no, not you, you. I mean, I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to the lady next to you. And it just came into my head at that moment, and it was so horrible, such a horrible thing to say, that there was a moment of complete disbelief, and then everyone laughed really hard because it was, you know, the guy should be taken out and shot. But it was just the kind of thing that I would think would be the most offensive thing you could do. I was trying to paint a picture of a guy who was really, really a bad guy, and so that any second that Woody's character stayed with this guy was an investment in bad time. You know?
I guess I've always wondered how you so intuitively seem to understand a certain type of really crude, ego-driven personality.
Well, that's a loaded question, Terry. But how do I understand it? I don't know. I think show business further, you know, can enrich that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you know, you can see people manifesting in a bizarre way that you know, other people don't try to get away. Wouldn't try to get away with, but people get lost in a vanity space and just start going. You know, people that just take themselves too seriously. It's ripe for recreation and. It made it a lot more fun to have it in the bowling world. It made it just seem a little bit more ludicrous. And that his affectations is, well, I mean, bowling in Elvis-like Elvis outfits and, you know, groupies, bowling groupies, and, you know, just a guy who was just on a sleaze roller coaster, you know, he never touched anything pure, if he could help it.
My guest is Bill Murray. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1999 interview with Bill Murray. I want to get back to Rushmore. Rushmore is set at an expensive private academy, and your character is a wealthy benefactor of the schools. What kind of school did you go to? Did you relate to this academy kind of experience at all?
Yeah, I did. I went to an academy. I went to a Jesuit academy in Chicago, in the suburbs, and most everybody had money, and I was one of the ones that did not have money. I worked in the summer, I caddied in the summer, and made enough money to pay my tuition, and then my money was gone. That was pretty much the money I made. So I would go through the school year without sufficient funds. I didn't have a car, and I didn't have, really a wardrobe to speak of. I used to take a lot of abuse for wearing golf shirts to school. Golf shirt, Murray, golf shirt. There were guys who would pimp you for wearing a golf shirt. I had inherited a collection of ill-fitting golf shirts from my older brothers, and that's what I wore to school.
Did you have a complex because you didn't have the money that the other students did, or you didn't have the clothes that they did?
I haven't heard complex in a while.
Me neither.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe I used the word.
Yeah,
I haven't either.
Heard complex. I had issues.
Issues. That's right.
But I had a complex issues there. I guess I had a complex. That's why I tip so heavy nowadays. I think I feel for people that, when I see somebody working in a golf shirt, my hands vibrate. Yeah, it was I guess I had a complex. It sounds worse than it was, but I remember it, and I remember growing up without it, and, I came from a big family, and there wasn't spare dough, and, and I get, think about a couple weeks ago, I got very upset with my boys, my older boys, because I said, God, you're spoiled rich kids. I'm a failure. I'm a total failure, and, they got very sad, and, well, that's who you are, Dad. That's who you were, blah, blah, blah. But they're actually really sweet guys, and, I was just giving them some tough love. But to grow up without money and now have money is just kind of it's a funny thing. I now loan money to the kids I knew in high school who've blown the money their parents left them, That's a kind of fun thing, But I don't know, to have a complex about it, well, I knew I wanted to pay my own way, and I felt very good to be able to provide my mother with things later in life. And, I remember the first year I made more money in Rima runs than my dad ever made, in a year. And I didn't even work. It was just reruns. And
right.
I thought, it's a funny world, funny life.
I know you have to go, so I'll just ask you one more question. Mm. Are you ever able to kind of sneak into lounges and watch lounge singer types?
Well, they usually catch me after a little while, and sometimes they get extremely nervous. Even the especially the musicians backing up, because they're like, oh, God. Because the guy performing may not get it. And I shouldn't say get it, but I mean, they're often in their own little world, so they don't even...
They actually think they're good.
They're out, yeah, and they're out of focus to the audience anyway. They don't really see. So it's fun to see the musicians behind them, and they'll spot me and go, oh, God. And they'll be embarrassed because they are backing up a guy that is the guy that I did on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And they'll be, like, winking, going, yeah, it's as bad as you say, and we got to do this every night. It's funny.
Did you ever want to sing for real?
Sometimes I think, God, I could have done this rock thing. This is no big deal. you just gotta, I've been watching VH1 Behind the Music, and all you gotta do is you just gotta fight through that drug addiction and the serious car crash, and then, it's the rebound where you rake the real money. But I thought about singing for real. I actually would like to be in a musical sometime, a Broadway musical. I think that'd be fun. I mean, so many of them are, horrid, but I always thought that was something I could do. I always thought that there was a place for a sort of an Americana kind of musical that I could do. I liked, when I first came to New York, I sublet an apartment, and the girl left me the entire history of the Broadway musical in record form, and I listened to them one by one.
Oh.
And it was really an amazing education to hear every single one of them. And there are not that many that are good, even ones that were hits. There's not that many that were really great. And I thought you could do this. And you could sing it more naturally than they sing it instead of that crazy Broadway style that they have.
Uh-huh.
You could do the crazy Broadway style for laughs in it, And if you did it for a Broadway crowd, you could do some real singing, and then you could ruin some stuff the way that they do, and you'd have you'd have an entertainment possibility.
Well, I'd like to hear that. I hope you get to do that.
I hope so, too.
Well, Bill Murray, it's really been a pleasure. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. I've enjoyed talking to you, too.
Bill Murray, recorded in 1999. In her new book, The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction, historian Linda Gordon recovers a lost incident in the history of the Wild West whose meaning reverberates far beyond its time. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction is a fabulous book, a spellbinding narrative history whose foundations rest on solid scholarly detective work. This is the kind of rigorous but engaging book that academics dream of writing. Its author, Linda Gordon, is an eminent women's historian whose previous books and articles, including The Standard History of American Birth Control, Women's Bodies, Women's Rights, have pretty much reached only an academic audience. But with The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction, Gordon has unearthed a long-forgotten story that's not only astonishing in its own right, but that also engages big, vexed intellectual questions about race, class, and gender in a dramatic, accessible fashion. No wonder Gordon quotes that famous line from the poet William Blake as the epigraph to her book, "To see a world in a grain of sand." The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction opens with an unforgettable image, one of many to appear in the chapters to come. On September 25, 1904, in New York City's Grand Central Station, 57 toddlers, all of them orphans of Irish Catholic descent, were squeezed into a special sleeping car on a train bound westward. They were accompanied by three nuns, four nurses, and one male child placement agent from the New York Foundling Home, which was then the premier child-saving institution in the city. The orphans had already been assigned to couples whose good Catholic credentials had been checked out. The journey away from New York would not only give these orphans a shot at upward social mobility, but as Gordon stresses, would transform them from Irish to white. For in turn-of-the-century New York, the Irish, along with other immigrant groups, were classified by their ethnicity in categories other than white. When the orphans, however, reached their journey's final destination, an isolated Arizona mining town called Clifton, something terrible happened. There to greet them was a crowd of eager white women who assumed that the orphans were up for grabs. Imagine their outrage then when they saw those pale Irish toddlers being placed into the arms of Mexican women. The priest in Clifton had been following his bishop's orders to locate good Catholic mothers for the children. Because this priest was newly arrived from Belgium, he was relatively oblivious to distinctions of skin color. In the awful hours that followed, the children were kidnapped from their assigned Mexican parents by a band of armed white vigilantes. The nuns and nurses, deserted by their male colleague and by the priest, were determined to save the orphans' souls, now in the hands of white Protestants. Alone, they faced a lynch mob of some 400 white townspeople, most of them, by some accounts, women. Run out of town the next day, the nuns, together with the foundling home, initiated legal proceedings to get the orphans back. The case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which concurred with an earlier ruling that stated that the party best able to provide for the children was not the degraded half-breed Indians, but the good women of the town. Gordon notes that no Mexican voices were heard at the trials. A silent image that speaks volumes, however, is embedded in the testimony of the foundling home attorney. He recalled that one of the Mexican mothers he visited showed him the clothing she had made in preparation for her child. Two red flannel skirts, two white skirts, one undervest, one red dress, underclothing, and a great deal of cloth that she had not yet sewn. Gordon alternates the chapters in which she recounts this arresting narrative with other chapters in which she carefully delves into, among other things, the history of American adoption, copper mining and labor relations, the so-called civilizing role of women on the frontier, Mexican immigration patterns, and most fascinating of all, the malleability of racial categories and the historical factors leading to their construction. In its dramatic sweep and scrupulousness, Gordon's book reminds me of the majestic works of the late and very much lamented journalist J. Anthony Lucas. But what sets The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction apart from his books, and particularly apart from other superb narrative histories, is that this is a story in which women are the primary actors, the monsters, the misguided, the victims. The narrative histories that dominate the bestsellers list these days are all about male adventures. D-Day, the Lewis and Clark, and the Shackleton expeditions. Gordon's book, however, treats readers to a gripping but unsentimental story about daring public assertions of female authority and the force of female desire. In the tradition of the very finest historians, Gordon makes us appreciate how very complex the truth of the past and its cast of characters really is.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction by Linda Gordon. Coming up, Keith Jarrett's new solo CD. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, you could think of Keith Jarrett's new solo piano CD as his basement tapes. Like Bob Dylan's famous sessions, it was recorded at the artist's home, was not initially intended to be released, and was made during a period when he was in seclusion and rumors were flying about his health. Kevin says the similarities between Jarrett's and Dylan's home recordings end there, but that Jarrett's album has something all its own.
Never Leave Me by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein. The piano sings very well at low volume, but on the bandstand or in the studio, improvising pianists seldom play that way. Either they're competing with a drummer or amplified bassist or trying to project to an audience. On Keith Jarrett's new solo CD, his best interpretations of standards convey a rare peace and quiet. The melodies are right up front and the accompaniment paired to a minimum. It's like he's arranged the music for church bells. Loves Your Porgy by Gershwin and Gershwin. It's from Keith Jarrett's CD, The Melody at Night with You. He recorded it himself at the end of 1997 as a Christmas present for his wife. Only later did he think about releasing it. He usually keeps the music quiet, if not always that quiet. But there are moments when Jarrett, the concert pianist, comes out and he goes for some grand gesture and the mood evaporates. Thank you. there are risks in trying to keep things so simple. Keeping the accent on melody and the background unobtrusive is also what cocktail pianists do, or the many new age piano players that Jarrett unwittingly inspired 20 years ago. They took to the way he'd set aside a jazz musician's traditional tools, namely swing time and blues feeling, to confront other strains of Americana. Besides the jazz vehicles, on his new one, Keith Jarrett plays the Irish-American standard, My Wild Irish Rose, his wife's name is Rose, and the Glee Club perennial, Shenandoah. Jarrett recorded this stuff, he was sidelined with chronic fatigue syndrome. It's tempting to draw a connection between this quiet music and that poorly understood condition, but that seems simplistic. Artists' choices are usually more complicated. For me, some of his playing here is as simply beautiful as shaker furniture, and sometimes he sounds like he's polishing the furniture. Jarrett walks a tightrope between what works and what doesn't. That makes his new CD less than the classic some folks hear it as, but it also keeps you paying attention to hear which side of the line he'll fall on. Any music that inspires close listening can't be bad and won't be mistaken for cocktail music.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Keith Jarrett's CD, The Melody at Night with You. Our senior producer this week has been Roberta Sherrock. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support from the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler. A collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens intimately chronicling our country's history. And from Beacon Press, publishers of All Souls, a family story from Southie by Michael Patrick McDonald. Available at bookstores everywhere. On the web at www.beacon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, new advances in pain relief. We talk to Dr. Scott Fishman, a specialist in pain medicine. And John Irving talks about adapting his novel, The Cider House Rules, into the new film. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.